Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. A black bear with a shimmering white coat. It's called the spirit bear, one of the rarest and most elusive animals on the planet. There could be as few as 50 to 150 of these bears on planet Earth, and they're only found in a tiny portion of the coastal temperate rainforests of British Columbia, an area aptly named the Great Bear Rainforest. Well, a new study led by researchers and members of the Kitisew Hehe and Gitgat First Nations found that the gene that causes the color variation in these bears may be even more rare than previously believed. So this hour on Point, we're going to hear the story of the spirit bear and efforts to protect and preserve not only this remarkable animal, but the ecosystem and the people that surround it as well. Well, joining us today is Doug Nieslas. He's director of the Kitisew Hehe First Nation Stewardship Authority. He's also former chief counselor of the Kitisew Hehe First Nation and author of the recent study, Spatial Patterns and Rarity of the White-Phased Spirit Bear Allele Reveal Gaps in Habitat Protection. The paper was published this month in the journal Ecological Solutions and Evidence, and he joins us from Kleptu, British Columbia. Doug Nieslas, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
And also with us from Cumberland, British Columbia, Canada, is Christina Service, science coordinator and wildlife biologist for the Kitisew Hehe First Nation Stewardship Authority. She's also co-author of that study I just referenced. Christina, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So I'd like to actually start with giving listeners a little taste of what this magnificent forest that these bears live in is like. Now, there's a fantastic documentary, as both of you obviously well know, called The Great Bear Rainforest, Land of the Spirit Bear. It was released last year and directed by Ian McAllister for McGilvray Freeman Films. And they followed the work that's being done to study and preserve the spirit bear. So let's first of all listen to how in the documentary the temperate rainforests of Western Canada are described.
The Great Bear Rainforest is the largest and most intact coastal temperate rainforest left on Earth. This place contains more life by weight than a tropical rainforest like the Amazon. Some of the largest trees here are more than 1,000 years old.
That's actor Ryan Reynolds providing the voiceover for the documentary Great Bear Rainforest. Doug, can you describe to us what this place is like?
Yeah, I would say this place is quite a magical place. I mean, this is one of the only places left that you'll get old growth and ancient growth forests, large biodiversity of wildlife out there. Some of these trees can be quite a few meters wide and, up to 200 to 300 meters tall. So you can get some really big trees out there. So.
Wow. And Christina, your thoughts, how rare is the temperate rainforest there?
Yeah, it's remarkably rare. I mean, I think often when people say rainforest, you think of the Amazon and the tropics. But I'd argue the temperate rainforests are just as magical. There's so much diversity, so many remarkable shades of green than you could even imagine with lichens and as Doug mentioned, these ginormous old cedars and Sitka spruces. The forest is something that almost I'd argue everyone should witness at some point in their lives.
I would agree. I mean, just the idea of these trees that are a couple of hundred meters tall, I think, Doug, as you said. And also, we should underscore, it's a coastal temperate rainforest. So it's a really, really interesting ecosystem. And in this magical place, there is this animal that has this brilliant white coat. I mean, so the Great Bear Rainforest documentary, Doug, just full disclosure, I've seen it four times. And the first time I saw it, my jaw just dropped. I mean, like literally dropped, because I could not believe what I was seeing when the first images of the spirit bear were on the IMAX screen in front of me. When did you first see this animal?
Well, I saw this in the early 2000s. It was actually my first time seeing it. And yeah. I remember I was actually, we just started up an ecotourism operation. And one of my first jobs, the guy I was working with said, go out and look for the spirit bear. Well, we had a bunch of guests with us. And I thought he was pulling my leg. I didn't think it existed. And he said, go look for this white bear. And as I went tromping through the forest, not expecting to find a white bear, I almost came face to face with it. And that was kind of my first time witnessing it. And this bear just walking through the forest with a salmon in his mouth and lay down right in front of me and started eating his salmon. And so that was kind of neat. And I was a bit surprised because I went back to my community and I asked some of the elders, you know, how come they never told me about this, you know, as a kid, or I've never heard about it growing up. And a lot of them were worried about the bears being hunted. So they never mentioned it, especially during the time of the fur trade. So they decided to keep it quiet.
Ah, that makes a lot of sense, to protect them, because they're so rare. I mean, Christina, what was the experience like the first time that you saw one?
Yeah, in some ways, sort of the opposite story of Doug, actually, because I started working up in Klemtu on the Bear Project about 8 years ago. And so during that time, that was sort of right when the Great Bear Rainforest was being hyped and more folks were starting to learn about spirit bears. And sort of the opposite impression was in place, that our beastie fairies of spirit bears. And so there's really this sort of perception that, you know, if you just go to the Central Coast, there's spirit bears wandering around the shores, and you're certain to see them, you know, carpeted along the intertidal zones. And so actually took me until my second year of doing field research to actually see one of these animals. And it was sort of surprising, because I had, you know, because of sort of all this hype and talk of spirit bears, there really was sort of an impression, and when you talk to people in cities especially, that, you know, if you're in this area, you're certainly going to see one. But as the research that we did points out, these animals are really, really rare, and you certainly need to know where to go. And even then, it's a privilege to get to see them.
Yeah. Well, so we'll get to the science that's being done to understand the spirit bear. But Doug, just briefly, I should ask, why are they called the spirit bears?
Well, I think people have always had a healthy respect on just their rarity. They're just extremely rare animals, only found in this part of the world. And it's kind of neat when you're in this dark green forest, you know, and you see this bright white bear come walking out. You know, I think it just has the spiritual presence about it. And so that's kind of it was coined spirit bear. But it was also actually a big campaign as well to protect this part of the world in the early 90s, when it was under threat from forest companies. They wanted to develop a name, and that was a name that was really used, using the spirit bear to help protect this region.
Oh, interesting. That is really interesting. Okay, so the relationship between First Nations people and the animals in this forest, and the work to protect it, I want to hear a lot more about that in a minute. So Christina, a black bear with a white coat. We're not talking about an albino variant here, right?
No. So they're not albino, so they have pigment. Contrast, albinos would have, you know, sort of the typical pink eyes and things you would associate with that. They're actually, in many ways, closer to sort of redheads in humans. So it's actually the same gene that controls the white coat in spirit bears as redheads and red hair in humans. And so they have the same pigment. But as Doug said, shockingly, in this forest, in this ecosystem, they're pure white from tip to tail.
Oh, interesting. And so that makes them, so they're not actually a subspecies then either. They're a variant of the black bear.
Yeah, exactly. So spirit bears, the white-coated spirit bears can breed with black-coated black bears as well. So they're not a separate subspecies. They're a sort of a rare variant or a rare form of black bears that only occur in this area.
Okay. And so we'll talk about the insights into the genetics behind the spirit bear in just a second. But before, we just got a couple of minutes before we have to take a break here, Doug. How rare are they? Do we actually know how many of these spirit bears are in the forest there?
No, I would say they're extremely rare. I mean, I've been working with bears now for a better part of 20 years. And, you know, some years I might see, I mean, the best year I've had, I've seen 11 in 1 year. And I've had seasons where I would see zero. And people would always have these different guesstimates. I don't think there was a lot of gumboot science. And so people would throw numbers like 400. And I've always thought there was nothing close to that. And so I think through this research basically hints at that, that there's a lot less than we thought.
A lot. So Christina, then what does that mean for the bear's future if there's even fewer than we thought?
Yeah, so it means a few things. So when you have really low numbers of anything, so we can think of endangered species, each individual is sort of disproportionately valuable. And so what we've learned from this research that shows that the gene that the sort of genetic change that controls the white coat is much rarer, up to 50% rarer than we thought, is that we maybe need to pay attention from a conservation and stewardship standpoint, that each individual is really valuable, and we might want to sort of focus our efforts on making sure we can do the best job of protecting habitat for these animals.
Well, Christina Service and Doug Nieslas, hang on here for just a moment. They're talking with us about the research that they've been doing on the spirit bear in the Western Canadian temperate rainforests. We'll learn a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're learning all we can this hour about the spirit bears of British Columbia. They are a rare genetic variant of the black bear. And a recent research led by scientists and First Nations members have found that these bears, these white-coated bears in the temperate rainforests of Western Canada, maybe even more rare than previously thought. Now, last year, a terrific documentary about this research came out called The Great Bear Rainforest. I just want to play another little clip from that movie. And here we're going to hear from Mercedes, who's a teen volunteer researcher with the Kitisou Hehe First Nation. She's 15 years old. She works with one of our guests helping collect hair samples of the bears for DNA analysis.
I'm a student field technician for the bear research team. I go out with the crew to these special bear sites around the territory and collect bear hairs. The bear's hair is basically like a fingerprint for bears. Using DNA from the hairs, we can discover lots of information about the bears. If they're male or female, how old they are, how much salmon they're eating, and how healthy they are.
A scene there from the Great Bear Rainforest. I'm joined today by Christina Service, science coordinator and wildlife biologist for the Kitisew Hehe First Nation Stewardship Authority, and by Doug Nieslas. He's stewardship director for the Kitisew Hehe First Nation Stewardship Authority. And Doug, Mercedes works with you in collecting these hair samples from the bears. Like, put me right next to you, put me right beside you on one of your collecting trips. How do you find genetic material from an animal that is so exceedingly rare?
Well, yeah, I think we try to look at different ways of doing research. And the traditional way was to use these collars, which we didn't want to do because that would impact the bears and their behavior. And so we decided to set up these barbed wire snags. And essentially, you put a scent pile in the middle, and then you set up this barbed wire that's about 80 centimeters. And then and basically, the bears can walk underneath to get to that scent pile, and then it leaves a tuft of their hair on the barb. So that barbed wire doesn't hurt them in any way, and their hair is already falling out. And so it just grabs a tuft of their hair, and we're able to send that fur to the lab and get it analyzed. And that's what Mercedes was talking about, that you can tell whether it's a male or female, how much food the bear has eaten the year before. There's a whole bunch of information on a little piece of hair.
And the hair has enough genetic material on it, like the follicle is, or I guess the from the follicle is still there?
Yes.
Okay. How do you attract the bears to the barbed wire?
So you put a scent pile, and maybe Christina can explain this because Christina's set up a million of these things. But you basically put this very stink scent pile in the middle, and you can smell that scent for miles, especially from a bear. They'll pick up that scent, and it'll track them in. There's no food out of it. They don't get a food reward out of it. It's just a smelly pile of sticks, essentially, and that'll attract the bears.
Well, Christina, scent pile is one of those wonderfully neutral scientific terms. What exactly do you put to create that scent?
Yeah, so the final product is an oily, gray, stinky, slimy fish sludge. So it's actually a product that originally starts as a commercial fish fertilizer, but they when people make commercial fish fertilizer, they want the opposite thing than we are trying for. They want it not to rot, and we want the exact opposite. So we actually mess with the pH from a fish fertilizer product to get it to rot for months and months and months in barrels. And from that, it as you can imagine, becomes more and more disgusting for humans, but more and more delectable for bears. And so sludge is probably the most accurate word, but there's no actual calories associated with it. So there's no reward for the bears in terms of item, which is really important because we don't want to habituate these bears into being food conditioned like garbage bears. Rather, we just want something that's very tantalizing for them to come basically check out our sampling site. But we have remote cameras that take video imagery and photos of the bears when they're on site as well. And we know they actually stay for, 45 seconds, 60 seconds, check out the sludge essentially, look mildly disappointed and then continue on with their day.
Okay. And so this is the way that sort of with the least impact on the bear, you're collecting the genetic material that's led to this conclusion that there perhaps 50, the allele that causes the recessive allele that causes the white coat is, what did you say earlier, Christina, possibly 50% less common than previously thought?
Yeah, exactly. So we use this method, which we didn't invent. It's used by sort of bear researchers across the world for non-invasive work, and it allows us to get a really in-depth insight into each individual bear that visits a sampling station. And so for black bears, if you and I were in the field and we're just watching them, it'd be quite apparent which ones are black and which ones are white, and we can know which ones are spirit bears. But between the black-coated bears, you and I wouldn't be able to tell which of those black bears are carriers, basically, of the genetic change that causes a spirit bear. So because it's a recessive mutation for these bears, some of the black bears can actually be carriers of this genetic change, but don't actually show the white coat. So that was a really important part of this whole project, is we're not just looking at where the white bears are, but are able to actually track that genetic change that occurs in both black and white coated bears.
Oh, interesting. Doug, did you want to tell me more about that?
Sorry, what was your question?
Well, about the tracking, about the genetic variant, not just in the white-coated bears, but in the black bears too, and what that's telling you about the population overall.
Yeah, I mean, these bears are extremely unique. These bears have been genetically isolated to the Outer Islands, and it is really difficult to tell what bear is a carrier for the recessive gene. And so I think it's really important that we protect all of the habitat, all of the those bears in this region, to make sure that we protect the white bears in general. So, and I should also say, go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, we also have a traditional story around bears, which was kind of interesting because it aligns with some of the science that we just completed. But in one of our traditional stories, we have the raven, or Gui. We call him the raven in our culture, as the creator of the world. And he also created the ice age. And as the ice started to recede, the raven wanted something to remind himself of the ice age. So as he was flying over, he decided to turn every 10th black bear white and set them on the Outer Islands. And those areas would be protected for all time as home of these spear bears. Now, really interesting, in our traditional story, it says 1 in 10 are white. Now our science has basically said that on these islands now, 1 in 10 of these bears are white, which is pretty interesting.
Wow. Look, we've got a lot of questions coming in about the bears from listeners online. So let me just ask a couple of here. Dana P says, great topic. How have these white spirit bears survived in the dark forest without any type of camouflage? Christina, I'm wondering what you think about that, because I wondered that too. They are so vibrant, set off from those dark greens of that temperate rainforest, that one would think that it would actually sort of that nature would select against this kind of coat. I mean, maybe it is because they're so rare, but like, why are there even any of them?
Yeah, it's a great question, because they absolutely are very conspicuous in these dark green forests. And so there's a few sort of thoughts around that. One is that the primary areas where these bears live, thankfully for them, don't have grizzly bears in these areas. So in areas where black bears and grizzly bears coexist, black bears usually get the short end of the stick. But because there's no grizzly bears around, that's sort of one point that works in their favor. So camouflage is maybe less of an issue if you don't have as many predators around. Of course, there's still wolves there. Another really interesting piece was actually looked at by Dr. Tom Reimken out of the University of Victoria a couple of years ago, that sort of flipped that idea on its head and said, yes, maybe to our eyes, spirit bears are really obvious and conspicuous in this landscape, but fish, which are the salmon, the most important sort of food resource for these bears, maybe it's actually the opposite. And so some work he did basically identified is that if you're a salmon and you're in a creek and you're, you know, looking up at in our part of the world, mostly dark gray overcast skies, there's actually less of a contrast with a white bear than a black bear. And so from a food perspective, that these bears actually maybe have an advantage, at least during the daytime, of being able to get closer to fish and basically trick them a little bit more. They're less obvious as a silhouette.
So it's like the ursine version of why some marine animals say are darker on top and lighter on the bottom, right?
Exactly.
That's really interesting. I mean, but look, all scientific theories, they are either proven or disproven by bodies of research that take years and years and years to put together. But I am curious, though, like that theory sounds really interesting. But on the other hand, we're having this conversation because the variant is so is actually so very rare. So, Doug, let me just do you buy the idea that it's just harder for the salmon to see the spirit bear when they're looking up at the sky?
Yeah, I actually worked with some of the researchers when they were doing this study, and they tried all different things like wearing white gumboots versus black gumboots. And when they wore black gumboots in the river, the salmon would develop a wide path around it and swim around the boots. Where the white boots, the salmon are almost swimming right into the boots. And so they put barrels in the river. And I worked with one researcher for about 4 years on the project, and it was pretty interesting to see the results.
Oh, that's fascinating. Okay, so let me circle back to one thing. So this is a study based on the genetic material that you collected through the processes that you just described. And have you tagged or collared any of the bears at all? Because I'm wondering how much we know about where they go, where they spend their time, or is that being accomplished, Doug, by tracking?
Yeah, I would say no, we haven't collared any of the bears, and we've actually tried to deliberately stay away from that. I think there's a lot of evidence that suggests that it can have negative impacts on bears and mating behavior. So we try to avoid that. And so it's pretty easy to track these bears. If you're walking through the forest and you are walking on a bear trail, you can look at the branches and they'll leave little tufts of hair. Sometimes there's bear rubbing trees where they'll leave a stomp trail that leads up to a bear rub tree, and you can look at the fur and you can tell exactly what color bear is rubbing on that tree. It could be a black bear, it could be a spirit bear, or it could be a grizzly bear. So we get a lot of information, and obviously just looking for tracks. And there's a number of ways I think you can track the bears. And
okay. So Christina, that people don't, researchers don't see the need to put a collar on any of these bears right now.
Yeah, it's a bit of a trade-off, right? So, as Doug said, there's some concerns over impacts of collaring, and that's why the nation partners for this project have sort of steered clear of that. But also from a data standpoint, for example, for the study, we were able to look at the genetics of 385 different black bears. And so if you essentially invest really heavily in a couple bears, because collaring's and tranquilizing and that process is far more expensive, you get really detailed information about far fewer individuals. So it's a bit of a trade-off. And for this study, because it's at a land scale, we opted basically to have this sort of broad stroke view. Another sort of advantage that we have going for us is that there's been strong investment in this project for many years. And so it would essentially, even though we only get sort of a snapshot in time of where that bear is, for many of these bears, we've been now tracking them for, you know, eight years. So we have a pretty good sense of, you know, which of the sampling sites in our area they're using sort of year after year. And that can give us some sense of, it's definitely more crude than collars, but some sense of things like home range size.
I see. Now, I want to circle back to something that you just said a couple of minutes ago, Christina, about the fact that perhaps the one of the greater threats to the black bear population overall there would be grizzlies. But that I think you said that grizzlies aren't really on the islands where the spirit bears live. But you also wrote a paper that says that like our changing climate is also changing where the grizzlies are. Are they moving into the areas of the forest where the spirit bears are?
Yeah, exactly. So the comment I made earlier was a sort of blanket statement of maybe what helped these bears exist up until present time. Some really surprising work that we did in 2014 actually looked that in these areas, essentially grizzly bears are found from this hair study and remote cameras where they're not supposed to be. So in our part of the world, grizzly bears are generally found on sort of these big mainland fjord systems that, you know, you can probably imagine from sort of the postcard image of these big estuaries and bears fishing for salmon and these really sort of big big landscapes. But increasingly, during this study, we kept finding grizzly bears actually on these islands, which up until recently have been sort of the turf or the domain of black and spirit bears. And so we don't know, to be clear, yeah, we don't know what's driving that movement of these grizzly bears moving west onto these islands. And we're still monitoring what that exact impact is going to be. But we do know in general that grizzly bears essentially give black bears a pretty hard time. So in some of the systems that we know, for example, or river systems that used to be spots where you could see spirit bears and black bears, we've now had grizzly bear families essentially move into those areas. And so one of the things we're trying to learn is, did those spirit bears and black bears move out of those systems entirely, or through our work with remote cameras, are they, you know, maybe actually just coming out at night, or sort of being more sneaky, essentially, because grizzly bears are around now? And so that's sort of one of the ongoing questions we're trying to look at.
Well, this hour, we are learning all we can about the spirit bear. It's a rare genetic variant of the black bear that lives in the temperate rainforests of British Columbia. Christina Service joins us. She's science coordinator and wildlife biologist for the Kitisew Hehe First Nation Stewardship Authority. And Doug Nieslas is also with us. He's stewardship director of that same organization and former chief counselor of the Kitisew Hehe First Nation. We'll talk a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are learning all we can about the spirit bear. It's a genetic variant of the black bear that lives in the temperate rainforests of Western Canada. And this black bear has a shimmering white coat. It's absolutely beautiful, and it's featured in a documentary that was released last year called Great Bear Rainforest. And there's a couple of scenes in this documentary I just want us to listen to together. Because first of all, we're going to hear Marvin and Nelson Robinson. They are a father and son stewardship team from the Gitgat Nation, and they spend a lot of time in the forest observing the spirit bears. And here's Nelson reflecting on the generational changes he hopes to be able to observe, specifically regarding one bear that's really featured prominently in the film. This bear's name's Mox, and Mox has passed her territory down to her daughter.
I'm going to be able to grow up on this creek, watching this young bear become the new old bear of the forest. My home is special, and I want to make sure these bears are always going to be a part of it.
And Nelson's father, Marvin, also talked about his hopes for the future of the spirit bear and for their shared ancestral home, that is the Great Bear Rainforest.
When I was young, we never spoke of the spirit bear. But Nelson is growing up in a time when our home is facing more challenges. If we can protect the bear, it will protect our home.
A scene there from Great Bear Rainforest, a documentary about the work that our guests today are doing in studying the spirit bear. Doug Nieslas, Marvin there is talking about challenges that your home is facing. What are those challenges?
I would say there's a number of challenges. I would say forestry is certainly an ongoing issue and loss of habitat. I would say global warming is certainly another major issue as ocean temperatures are rising. Major decline in salmon numbers. I mean, historically, some of our rivers used to have about 80,000 salmon, and some of those same systems now are down to about 4,000 or 5,000 salmon. So we're continuing to monitor some of these issues and try and do what we can in terms of protection.
So how closely bound up are the bears, the forests, and the future of the First Nations that have been living there?
Yeah, in our culture, our elders have always said everything is connected. You know, if you take one thing out, it affects everything else. And so, for instance, if you lose salmon, you know, it's going to affect the forests, it's going to affect the bears. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's really important that we look at things from a bit of a holistic perspective and look at protecting quite large regions to protect all the biodiversity in these areas.
Now, so about that biodiversity, I've said this a couple of times. I'm just going to say it one more time. It's the spirit bear is a genetic variant of the black bear. We're not talking about a separate species or a subspecies or an endangered species. And I make that distinction because, in a sense, you could say it's still just a black bear. But even though there's a great deal of wonderful science to be done to understand this particular genetic variant, you had also said earlier, Doug, that this beautiful, rare creature allows the First Nations people there a chance to draw attention, sort of positive and conservation-based attention, to the health of that temperate rainforest. I mean, is that one of its most important roles right now?
Absolutely. Yeah, I believe the spirit bear is, you know, for a big part, is the face of the Great Bear Rainforest. I know back in the 90s, this area was all slated to be cut. It was all on the chopping block, and the government gave it all of these permits to all the forest companies, and they were going to knock it all down. And it was because of First Nations communities and environmental groups that really came together and coined the term Great Bear Rainforest. And really, it was a big surge to protect, you know, a lot of this region. And certainly the spear bear was a catalyst. This is the only part of the world that you'll find a spear bear. So.
Huh. And Christina, how much of the Great Bear Rainforest is now protected from logging, for example?
Yeah, it varies sort of where you, depending on where you are in the Great Bear. So people generally refer to the Great Bear as an area that stretches from sort of the tip of northern Vancouver Island all the way up to sort of the Alaskan Panhandle. Kitisuhehe's territory is sort of smack in the middle of that. And where we do this work, about 50% of the territory through the Great Bear Rainforest Agreements were put aside into protected areas, which is, you know, tremendously high for most areas of the world.
Would you like to see more, though, set aside? Is it enough? Based on the research that you're putting out about the rarity of this genetic variant?
Yeah, I think there's an interesting point there. One is what we learned from this research is sort of finer scale detail on where we need to be targeting our efforts. And so we learned sort of at a finer spatial scale that if we're looking at more protection, here are the areas that we need to look at. And that's just a resolution of information we didn't have before this process. So we're hoping to use this information, adaptive, basically conservation planning. And as Doug said, these bears are really important culturally in the region, and also increasingly economically for viewing. And so at least for the Kitisuhehe's nation, there's a strong desire to take a really precautionary approach here, and sort of err on the side of caution in terms of providing the best available habitat for these bears to thrive.
Now, the reason why I ask, and Doug, I'll just turn back to you on this, is because in the paper that that the two of you co-authored, there's a discussion of what, now that you know a little bit more about sort of where the spirit bears are and more about sort of their spatial patterns, as the title says, there's a discussion of that it reveals gaps in habitat protection, so that there are specific places that you think in the rainforest that deserve more protection based on what you know about the bears now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think with this new science, I think we've identified some hot spots of spear bears, and the existing protected areas that came out of the Great Bear Rainforest Agreement did not protect those areas. And so I think we want to go back and look at how we can address that. And I think we have to look at new models of protection. In the past, through the Great Bear Rainforest Agreement, we protected areas under a conservancy. And under a conservancy, you can still go and hunt black bears, which I think is a major issue. So we want to propose some new models, whether that's developing an indigenous protected area. And that's where it's kind of a First Nations-led protected area where we can protect everything in there, including hunting. Or we can look at a community stewardship area, but I don't think we can look at the provincial designations of protected areas. And I think we need to look at something new.
So can you tell me then more about what the Kitisu Hehe First Nation Stewardship Authority does? I mean, is the Stewardship Authority in charge of the protection and management of the Great Bear Rainforest?
Yeah, I mean, this has been an ongoing discussion, but yeah, First Nations are levels of governments. First Nations have been here for thousands of years, and we're just going to continue to assert our authority and jurisdiction over our land and water. And so we developed our office in around 2011 under the authority of the hereditary chiefs from my community. And they said we have a responsibility, a mandate to go and take care and steward these areas. And so we try and work with different levels of government, but we have essentially developed our own land use plan, our own marine use plan, and we're going to implement those plans. And so we basically do everything from, you know, land use planning, marine use planning, language. We have a watchman program that gets out there and monitors and patrols the territory. We also have a number of science programs. So like Christina, we hired Christina as a PhD student to come in and drive a lot of the science and merge that with local knowledge. And that's giving us the best information. So when we go to those government tables, we are armed with a ton of information. So
it's interesting, and I ask this because if I heard you right, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I think it sounded like you said that when the original Great Bear Rainforest Agreement was signed or agreed to, that First Nations thought that there wouldn't be any hunting of any black bears, but that turned out not to be how the agreements panned out. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, when we thought we signed off on protected areas, we thought everything was protected within those protected areas. And as it turns out, that's not the case. And we were dealing with trophy hunters, so hunters from all over the world that would come and shoot these bears for a sport, chop off their head, take their fur, and leave these bears. And so spear bears are protected, but black bears and grizzly bears were not. And just more recently, the government just protected grizzly bears, which is great. And now we are working on the black bears next.
Okay. And I understand that you're also working on an entirely new designation of what a protected area might mean. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So we are talking about, we're developing an indigenous protected area. And I would say the current model right now, the conservancy model, does not allow First Nations input into management. And that's been really unfortunate. We think we have a lot of knowledge we can share, both traditional knowledge and local knowledge. And so we're developing a new designation where First Nations will be more involved in the management. And so we want to protect their cultural sites. We want to protect wildlife. We want to make sure that these areas are taken care of. And we want to make sure that our watchmen that we put on the ground have the authority to implement that. So we're developing these new designations. We're trying to work with the province and the federal government to develop these new designations. But with or without their consent, we're going to develop these plans and move forward with them. So,
and is there... is there openness to the idea from the provincial government or the Canadian government?
We've had some success with the provincial government so far. We do have a table with them and are continuing to have ongoing discussions. Not so much with the federal government yet, but we're still in the works of developing the management plan. We're very close now to completing one. And we're continuing to have these discussions and trying to advance it as much as we can. At the end of the day, you know, the nations do have a responsibility to take care of these areas. And so we're going to continue to try and build it through legislation, but we're also just going to assert it as well. So.
Yeah. And Doug, I appreciate you fielding these questions from me, because to be frank, down to the south of you here in the United States, there can be sometimes the tendency to idealize Canada a little bit. But I just wanted to explore sort of the realities of what the relationships are like between First Nations and provincial and the Canadian federal government, because there are lots of examples where it's been quite terrible. I mean, I'm thinking about how First Nations have been treated, say, for decades in the development of Hydro-Québec on the other side of the country. So I just wanted to sort of explore the complexity with you a little bit, and I appreciate you sort of wading through that with me. Christina, based on the science that you and Doug and other members of the Stewardship Project have been doing, how important do you think it is to move towards what Doug was talking about sort of an Indigenous protected designation?
Yeah, I think that model could be really valuable, and as Doug mentioned, could maybe fill some of these gaps that we've identified through the science. I think there's also, when we talk about in the paper discussion, other tools as well that the nation has at its disposal, in terms of, you know, maybe direct negotiations with the forestry company, which is going to be more on a site by site basis. But I think as a sort of a broader approach, Indigenous protected areas offer a lot of promise.
I see. Well, we've just got a couple of minutes left to go, and I have to ask, because we're having this conversation about this rare species, a beautiful forest, and we're also, like, planet Earth is living through a pandemic as well. Christina, have you been able in the past couple of months to go and do the field work, or have you not been able to?
Yeah, this has been, I mean, a strange year, obviously, on many fronts. So yeah, this year I haven't been in the field. I will be next week, but usually that field work sort of starts in early May for us. So yeah, very, very different year. Related to the nation's interests in adequate stewardship for spirit bears and black bears and grizzly bears, we actually started a new project this year that we developed really rapidly with university partners to actually monitor this year as a strange anomaly where we're actually not going to have any tourism pressure on these bears as well. So it's been strange in terms of field work and how our programs usually work, but we've also been able to pivot and hopefully get some new data out of this year as well, as an opportunity to sort of monitor a baseline year of what these bears do in the absence of human pressure.
Mm. Hmm. Well, Doug, I mean, what impact has the pandemic had on the Kitisou, Heihei, and even the Gitgat nations?
Yeah, so I can't speak for Gitgat as they're a neighboring community, a lot of it is probably fairly similar. Our community's gone on a complete lockdown, so nobody coming in, nobody going out, and that's really affected a lot of our work. But we've been able to just amend some of our projects. And luckily we actually had more local people. So Mercedes, one of them this year, that helped with our bear research. So we were out there for quite a few weeks, continuing on with the study, which has been great. And I should say it's had some positive effects. I mean, the fact that there's no tourism this year, there's a window to see if bears will behave a bit differently and allow us to get in there and develop management plans, accordingly. So, kind of an opportunity in some ways.
Yeah, an opportunity in the midst of a disaster, but at the same time, in the long run, having a well-managed tourism industry is really important, as you said earlier, for the First Nations there as well. But listen, we've run out of time, and I cannot thank both of you enough for sort of letting us tag along on your research and your exploration and your understanding of the spirit bear. Doug Nieslas, Stewardship Director for the Kitisou Heihei First Nation Stewardship Authority, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, Magna.
And Christina Service, Science Coordinator and Wildlife Biologist, also for the Stewardship Authority. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much, Magna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.